I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The sound of Iraqis near a burning U.S. military Humvee today outside Fallujah, the same city in which four American security contractors were killed yesterday, their bodies then mutilated and dragged through the streets. Coalition Administrator Paul Bremer said there would be a response.
The acts we have seen were despicable and inexcusable. They violate the tenets of all religions, including Islam, as well as the foundations of civilized society. Their deaths will not go unpunished.
Marine First Lieutenant Wade Zirkel, speaking from the outskirts of Fallujah, said pacifying the city will take time.
We've gone in on several occasions since we've been here, so, you know, we're not afraid to go into the town. We're eager to go in there, win the hearts and minds of the people, and provide a secure environment for a new and free Iraq.
Well, we turn now to Kimberly Dozier, who's in Baghdad as a correspondent for CBS News. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you.
Kimberly, what can you tell us about the bodies? Have they been picked up by the coalition authorities?
We understand that the coalition forces in the area, the Marines, asked the Iraqi police to retrieve them. The police say they brought them out wrapped in blankets. Now, we also spoke to the top general here, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, and asked him why the Marines hadn't gone in earlier. Why did it take them 10 hours to get those bodies out of Fallujah? And he told us that that was the decision of the local commander on the ground. We can only surmise that he thought at that point this wouldn't be a rescue mission, that he would be putting his troops in harm's way to retrieve bodies.
Civil Administrator Paul Bremer has vowed that those who did this will pay for it. What evidence is there that some kind of military operation may be forming around Fallujah, if any?
Well, we did see U.S. Marines throw a cordon around the area last night. Today, there were also Iraqi police checkpoints on all the entrances going in and out of the city, checking ID cards, things like that. Now, in past operations, what has happened after previous incidents, they have taken the evidence that they can find from the incident, gone to local Iraqi contacts, tried to find out who was involved, and then basically stake out their territory before going in and going after those they suspect of carrying out these crimes. We can only presume that's what they're doing right now. General Kimmett, again in his press conference today, stressed that U.S. forces will be going back into Fallujah at a time of their own choosing in a way that is organized and when they've had a chance to study their adversary.
Kimberly, the Marine lieutenant we just heard from in our introduction referred to winning hearts and minds. How's that going in Fallujah?
It's been an uphill battle for the 82nd Airborne and the incoming Marines. The outgoing generals said that one of the things they tried to do, for instance, was provide jobs in the area and open schools, open hospitals, and he could show you statistically that they'd done an amazing job on that. What he said, however, was it was very disheartening that after a year of having American forces there, that so many of the people were still resistant to their help.
How characteristic is what happened in Fallujah of the majority sentiment of Iraqis throughout the country?
It's not. You get a sense that people are resentful of the U.S. occupation, absolutely, but the kind of bloody, brutal attack of the bodies that we saw yesterday, that's not normal. Now, the problem is the guerrillas have decided that since soldiers are getting harder and harder to get, they're going after anyone who looks foreign. And that, well, it widens their targets, but it means that our freedom of movement is more and more curtailed, and that even the media, like CPA officials here, the U.S. coalition officials here, can't get out, talk to the people, and either, in our case, see what they're thinking, or in their case, try to find out what they need and help them.
Kimberly Dozier of CBS News joining us from Baghdad. Kimberly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Whether to present particularly brutal images of war or violence on a television news program or on a front page, can be an excruciating decision for a news executive, a decision that had to be made yesterday when graphic video and photographs from Fallujah, Iraq, became available. Well, to discuss what goes into deciding what to present to the public, we're joined now by Kenny Irby of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in Florida. Welcome, Kenny.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bill.
Kenny, what's that balance that must be struck by news executives when images this graphic come into a newsroom?
It's a tremendous balance of actually maximizing truth-telling and reporting the realities of a horrific experience to a country of people who are very concerned and involved, and then also minimizing harm to the family members and loved ones who may not be aware and have not been fully informed about the plight of what potentially are their loved ones.
Can't a news executive always argue, however graphic the images may be, that this is reality?
I think one could, but there is a level of how necessary these images are and what range of alternatives the media organization chooses to publish before its audience, because there is a point where you can go to gratuitous violence or gratuitous graphic imagery that's not really necessary to make the point and honest and fairly report the significance of the event.
You know, CNN eventually aired fairly graphic imagery from what happened in Fallujah, but initially they did not. And a CBS executive said at that point that CNN was showing so much restraint, it wasn't really covering the story.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge when you're dealing with the competition issues and that particularly cable organizations and now increasingly web organizations are dealing with. The newspaper often has a luxury and a benefit of being able to be more reflective and thoughtful about the decisions that they make, whereas on the TV and the broadcast area, those are really instantaneous decisions where you can go live. And I think it's the competition to publish first. There's a danger in that if there's not solid ethical decision-making process in place and clarity of mission and purpose discussed within the organization.
You know, Kenny, readers of the New York Times woke up to pretty graphic imagery, a big photograph on the front page of bodies hung from a bridge in Fallujah, the sort of imagery that wasn't put on broadcast TV right away. What's the difference in impact, do you think, if any, of pictures on the front page of a newspaper and pictures on television?
There's a tremendous difference, I would say. I think in terms of broadcast, while the images and the audio and the sensory experience is much more ephemeral and it happens quicker, the compound value of that being played over and over has some significance that needs to be taken into consideration. But for a newspaper and the New York Times, which I agree did take a bold position in bringing that picture forward of the bodies, the charred bodies, the reviewer, the reader and viewer spends a lot more time analyzing and synthesizing that frozen moment, that 500th of a second that's been frozen. But also the newspaper has the luxury and the benefit, again, of knowing that the video has been seen, the likelihood that someone would see that picture for the first time in the New York Times is probably fairly unlikely, and I think that is part of the decision-making process.
These terrible pictures appeared on the Internet, even on the websites of some of the news organizations that weren't airing the pictures on television before they appeared anywhere else. What do you make of that?
The thought process I've found is that organizations feel like there's a different audience on the web. These are people who are intentionally seeking this kind of information versus people who newspapers are very cautious about offending through many litmus tests like the cereal test, the breakfast Cheerio test, and what if my child picks up this newspaper test.
We've been joined by Kenny Irby of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Kenny, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
It's estimated that for every 10 U.S. soldiers in Iraq, there is one civilian contractor working for a nonprofit company. And when they are killed, as the four Blackwater security employees were yesterday, their deaths are not included in the tally of war casualties. Roughly 30 contractors have been killed in Iraq since the start of the war. Britain's Centurion Risk Assessment Services is, like Blackwater, a company that provides security in Iraq. Joining us on the line from London is Paul Rees, the company's director. And Paul, after hearing about yesterday's events, were you in immediate contact with your people in Iraq?
We were. It is a frightening aspect of that, hearing that news. And we're always obviously worried, is it one of our guys that's been hit or attacked or whatever? So we always stay in touch at least daily by emails. They check in and say, it's nothing to do with this, we're all okay, et cetera, et cetera.
What are your employees doing there?
We train journalists, NGOs, aid workers, business people to operate in hostile environments such as Iraq. Our guys will also go across to aid them, assist them in security, on-site awareness, and also advisory capacity of going around a place like Baghdad or throughout Iraq, advising them on safety and security.
Paul, I understand that the Blackwater Company here in the U.S. is made up in large part of ex-Navy SEALs. Your company is made up largely of ex-members of the Royal Forces in Britain. Is it a lucrative job for them? How much do they make a month, roughly?
They make, on average, about £2,500 a month. But remember, there's no money that can replace what's happening over there at the moment.
I guess, Paul, what I'm asking is, here in the U.S., private forces can make up to $15,000 a month. So I guess my question is, are your people choosing your organization rather than choosing the Royal Forces because of the money?
No, not at all, because most of these guys have all done their full time, their full stretch in the services. Mm-hmm. So they're all kind of retired. So this is an additional job, really.
Well, what do you say of some of the criticism of these private forces? I'm sure you've heard them. Here in the U.S., there's talk of streamlining the armed forces and transferring a lot of the work in places like Iraq to private contractors, such as your company. And yet some say that that means that there's sort of a disconnect between how many people are actually being killed on the ground and what kind of a tally of dead the war is having. Do you hear that criticism?
Yeah, we hear criticism all the time. Being a managing director over in England, sitting in a seat behind an office, obviously we hear a lot. The biggest concern we have as a professional company, a civilian company using ex-servicemen, is the larger companies who are employing any ex-military person they can get their hands on. And basically it's a cowboy operation. They're not highly trained in the areas that they're going into. They may have done 3 or 4 years service and not seen any active service, but that's the problem of a bigger company going over there, a civilian company contracted by, shall we say, the US government or UK government to basically assist and then finally take over the US forces locations. They do not have, not all of them, have the adequate training that is required for that hostile environment at the present time.
Paul, one last question for you. The pictures coming out of Iraq after yesterday's incident are horrifying. How is that impacting you? Are you seeing people shying away who might have been giving you applications? What are you hearing?
No, not really. We're inundated with CVs on a daily basis. So it's their own personal records to say, is there any job vacancies? And yes, I do want to go to Iraq. But these pictures are frightening. But they do give everyone, whether employed in Iraq or back in UK or USA, a wake up call to say, hey, this is happening and it's getting worse. What's going to be done about it?
Paul, thank you very much.
You're more than welcome. Pleasure to speak to you.
Paul Rees is Director of Centurion Risk Assessment Services. He spoke to us from London. By the way, earlier I said companies like Paul's were non-profit. Of course, I meant to say for-profit.
Just ahead, we speak with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright about the risks of mixing God and foreign policy.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Should the Secretary of State forgive those who trespass against the U.S. 70 times 7, as the Bible says? When a government kills to fight evil, does that government also sin? Does a country still have the right to manifest destiny? These and other interesting questions were posed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in a speech this week at the Yale Divinity School. Religion and policy have been in the news at home in the debate over gay marriage and the pledge, and in Iraq, which a Marine commander recently called a God-sized challenge. But presidents often invoke God. Before she delivered her speech Tuesday, we asked Secretary Albright, is the Bush administration any different?
Well, I think that there is much more of a sense that there is a mission out there on behalf of God. Not so much a mission on behalf of democracy or America or the rights of the individual, but more of the way that phrases are used about God supporting the development of an empire as is peculiarly stated in a Christmas card from Vice President Cheney.
I have it here. He writes, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his, capital H, notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? How do you feel the Bush administration's language is now?
I mean, I think President Bush has been increasingly careful in the way that he states some of his arguments. But what has happened is this kind of sense that we are God's destiny, which I think is possible for people to believe internally, but should not be the war cry.
What would you have President Bush do?
I think it's possible to talk about evil in the world without bringing God into the mix. What I would have him say, there has to be an end to the terrorism where innocent people are being murdered, and that this is not a mission from God, but a mission of humanity and the importance of the individual. Because my own sense is the more he mentions God, the more it gives force to the jihad, which thinks that God is on their side. That's the problem.
Just keeps ratcheting it up.
Yes.
And as you said, you don't really, I mean, I know how this is going to come out as soon as I say it, but you don't really need God to tell you that murder is wrong.
Absolutely. You don't. We know it.
What would you say, though, to people who say the U.S. is an increasingly religious country? Something like 48% of Americans go to church as opposed to 14% in Britain, 7% in France. And many Americans embrace this language.
Well, what we do know from polling data is that one of the great things that divide us from other democracies in Europe is this sense of religion. And I have always believed, actually, that the U.S. is an exceptional country and, you know, it was founded by people who wanted to escape persecution. But I think that that's different than kind of putting God on our team. And as I say, I think that it's interesting to have this kind of internal belief, but it's very different from executing it in foreign policy. Mm-hmm. I believe in God, and I think it is very important for our leaders to feel that they are operating within a world where there is some other ultimate power. But that is very different from saying, you know, I have God on my side. That's the part that I found so difficult. Yeah. God on my team, when the other team thinks they have God, is just too exacerbating of the problems that we already have.
And it's a war you can't win. Really,
well, you can't. And, you know, unless God comes down and says, you're my guys, and that is not going to happen.
Well, as you know, some people increasingly think it's going to. But that aside, you delivered this speech as advice to President Bush in part. And some would say it's a partisan jab.
I suppose anything any of us say at this point is viewed as a partisan jab. I don't see it as a partisan jab. What I've been doing, Robin, is to try to explain why it is at this time that the United States is regarded so poorly. There's polling data that shows that the reputation of the United States is getting lower and lower, that our credibility is lower and lower, and that the divisions between us and the rest of the world are greater and greater. One of the problems I see in the world today is that it is alienating other countries when the United States arrogates God just to us. He is not just our God. And I think that that creates increasing divisions. And so from a perspective of a foreign policy practitioner, that's the reason for giving the speech and not as a partisan jab.
And Madam Secretary, one last question before we let you go. You just recently spoke to the 9/11 Commission. Do you think it was appropriate for Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief, to apologize on behalf of the U.S. government and two administrations, including the one that you were involved in, for the events of 9/11?
Well, I think that we actually all need to show compassion and sympathy for those who have lost a family in 9/11. And, you know, I think apologizing is, it's a very natural feeling when you're sitting with people who are suffering and you did play some role. I have said to many people, for instance, when I brought bodies back from our embassies that were blown up in Kenya and Tanzania, and I met with the families, I just kept saying, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And I think that if you have any position of responsibility, I think that Dick did what was very natural, and I don't think it should be viewed as arrogant or anything like that. I think that
did you have the same feeling when you were sitting there? You were also looking at those families. Did that thought cross
your
mind?
Yes, and I went and I talked to them, and I phrased it a little bit differently. I said that we all owed it to the families to find out what had happened here. Finding out what has happened is basically a form of apology in terms of trying to figure out, for their sake and for all the rest of us, how this happened and it shouldn't happen again.
Madeline Albright, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Madeline Albright, former Secretary of State with the Clinton administration.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Over the past 25 years, more than a million couples have turned to in vitro fertilization to start a family. And now, the Bush administration is urging more scrutiny of the lightly regulated infertility industry. A report issued by the President's Council on Bioethics calls for more study into the health of babies born by in vitro fertilization and the health of their mothers. It also offers guidelines on the types of procedures physicians can employ. Pamela Mattson is with the American Infertility Association, an education and advocacy group. She testified yesterday before the Bioethics Council, and she joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Just can you tell us, what are some of the key facets of the report?
Well, there are some good things about this report. They're encouraging the federal government to fund independent outcome studies for children conceived through assisted reproductive technologies.
What does that mean, though? An earlier draft of this panel's report suggested that IVF babies be tracked from birth through life. Does the new report suggest that babies should be followed from birth on up to see how their health develops?
Well, Robin, what was actually suggested by the council originally was a mandatory IVF children's registry. What the council is now supporting is prospective outcome studies that would be voluntary in nature. That's a really big difference.
Why is that important to you, that those children be studied?
No one cares more about our kids than infertile people. This is our children. We want to make sure our kids are healthy, but we want it done right.
We understand that the panel is also urging Congress to ban experimental procedures as well as conception by any means other than the union of egg and sperm.
There are parts of this report that we have to be very, very careful about.
What's your concern there?
Well, the concern is the language is very ambiguous. What does that mean? Egg and sperm. Well, you know, the average listener may say, well, it means a man and a woman. But it's really more complicated than that. We have very new, innovative technologies that could possibly not be considered part of just the union of egg and sperm. And we want to make sure that innovative technologies are available to patients.
You know that there's been a lot of criticism of this panel. It was criticized for replacing a scientist who opposed President Bush's prohibition of embryonic stem cell research.
Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned that this is an ideological panel?
Well, we were very concerned about that. I've been one of the most outspoken people. The first report was full of that kind of language when they called an embryo, nascent human life, and children to be. But the council was very receptive and took out much of that politically driven language. It's all gone. For what I have read so far of the report, it is all gone now. They've been responsive to that. As far as scientists being removed from the panel, of course that's very disappointing to everybody because, yes, this is an ethical panel, but it's about medical decisions and scientific decisions, and we need the hearts and minds of true scientists on this council.
This is such an important thing to people. It is the center of many families. Should in vitro fertilization specifically be more regulated by the government?
You know, frankly, I don't think so. There is a tremendous amount of regulation and licensing already in place, and we have over 1 million babies born. And, you know, so I think that we've been doing very, very well as a field of medicine. We're a new field of medicine. But the fact is that we do have this report. It's not going away. And so we have to deal with it.
Pamela Madsen, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Pamela Madsen is with the American Infertility Association.
The United Nations today announced that it has stopped delivering food to the Gaza Strip. The UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has been providing food to about 600,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The agency began its work 49 years ago. It stopped now because of restrictions imposed by Israel on the removal of empty food containers. Well, we're joined on the line now by Peter Hansen, the Commissioner General of UNRWA. Welcome, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you.
Mr. Hansen, why have you decided to stop food aid to Gaza?
Because the conditions for bringing in food has become so impossible that we can no longer do it. And this is a decision we have taken in harmony with the World Food Program, with whom we share the burden of feeding the refugees and non-refugees in the occupied territories.
Tell me about the specific conditions that have driven this decision. Conditions are always difficult and dangerous in Gaza.
Well, yes, we have worked under very difficult and very dangerous conditions over the past 3.5 years and in 49 years before that. But the situation has not been as difficult as it is now, or rather we have been brought to the point where we simply cannot continue, because if we cannot take our containers out of Gaza, we cannot bring new containers in.
Now, why can't you take your containers into Gaza, your food containers, or rather out of Gaza? What's that about?
That is about Israel not allowing us to bring the empty containers out. And I have had no reason giving for that. If I got an answer to our many questions, it would be that it was security considerations. But I find it very difficult to see why empty containers cannot be extremely quickly screened so they can pass into Israel, with all due respect to Israel's security concerns. They're legitimate security concerns. We are not calling that.
Well, indeed, an Israeli spokesman told the BBC that perpetrators of a double suicide attack on the 14th of March, which killed 10 people in the Israeli port of Ashdod, hid in containers to get into Israel.
Yes, as far as I know, and we have seen no evidence of that, that was probably full containers where there was something these perpetrators could have hidden behind. But I'm talking about completely empty containers, and that should not be impossible to find out who's there unless whoever's there has the ability to make themselves invisible.
Mr. Hansen, how many Gazans depend on this food aid?
Well, it's about 600,000 Gazans who depend on this food aid. It's about 1.2 million in the occupied territories, but we hope that these things will not have immediate repercussions on the West Bank refugees. But as I said, about 600,000 people depend on this food aid.
Now, what will happen to them? Will this literally mean they won't have enough to eat?
They would have even less to eat than they have now. We have, because of budgetary restrictions, been forced to reduce this food aid from 60% of daily caloric intake requirements to only 20% by now. We have high malnutrition rates, and I'm afraid that this means that the malnutrition rates will go even higher and we might face the prospect of real hunger in Gaza.
This must have been an excruciating decision for you and the others who work for UNRWA.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It has been very, very difficult, but we see no choice at the moment, because if we went ahead and just blindly bringing in aid without getting the empty containers out, we have no idea at all about what the cost would be, and we could very easily run out of all funding for food aid in the future. We hope that the Israelis will take up the consideration, and this is a temporary suspension.
Peter Hansen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Hansen, Commissioner General of the UN Relief and Works Agency.
Still to come, Tom Perata, the author of the best-selling book Election, is out with a new novel. This time his topic is parenthood.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We received a lot of response to our coverage of the 9/11 hearings. Raymond Jantz of Cottonwood, Arizona writes, American policy is and has been for many years determined by political posturing and positioning and partisan bickering and wrangling. This is getting really serious. People are paying with their lives.
Jeff O'Byrne of Jacksonville, North Carolina wrote, following our interview with Greg Barker, the producer of the Frontline documentary Ghosts of Rwanda, Jeff thought that the answer to a question I asked Greg was obvious. Jeff thinks force is necessary to defeat evil. So we called Jeff and asked him, are those who say violence just breeds more violence being naive?
I think so. You have to accept the fact that the evil is going to be in the form of violence and will not be stopped any other way.
Yeah. You know, there are cases that seem clear-cut, Jeff, like defeating Hitler, for example. But what do you say, for example, to critics of the Iraq War who say using force there will only increase terrorism?
I think that you have to go back to Mogadishu. In Mogadishu, the United States set the pain tolerance at less than 18 KIAs by pulling out immediately after the night of the Black Hawks. Rwanda reaffirmed that. And the action in Kosovo was the same thing. We will accept no casualties. That perception is obviously endemic in the bad guy side of the world, and that has to be corrected.
Jeff, you said KIA, meaning?
Killed in action.
What about winning hearts and minds?
That comes too, but you have to establish a security environment first that allows the hearts and the minds to be expressed.
Jeff O'Byrne, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome, sir.
Well, our story on how the price of gasoline has become a political football drew this comment from Michael Ellis of Springfield, Pennsylvania. Compared with increases in the price of food and other commodities, gas at $2 is still cheap.
While Elizabeth Kennett took issue with some of our language. Please, please, please stop referring to Marines as soldiers. Soldiers are in the Army. Marines are not. To a civilian, this may seem like a small thing. But as the wife of an active-duty captain of Marines who happens to be currently deployed, I can tell you it irks every Marine I know. There's an enormous difference in the respective services. You would never mistake a Democrat for a Republican and vice versa. Marines and soldiers are just about as distinct.
Our interview with Wayne Slater, senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, drew this criticism from Fannie Campbell, who writes, he referred to White House advisor Karen Hughes as Karen. I thought it rather condescending. Does he call Dick Cheney Dick or Bill Clinton Bill? Could it have anything to do with her being a woman? Or would he say girl? Well, Fanny, perhaps not, but we should note that Wayne did call Carl Rove Carl.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Author Tom Perotta specializes in shedding light on the darker side of modern suburban life, though with more dark humor than other novelists who often set their tales in the burbs, like John Updike or Richard Yates. Perotta's main characters are very average Americans, searching for meaning in very ordinary places. Overgrown schoolyards and overcrowded community pools, bright kitchens and high school gymnasiums. Places most of us know, which may be why the characters in a Perotta book can seem like people we know. In his last book, Election, Perotta satirized a high school race for class president. In 1999, it was made into a movie starring Reese Witherspoon as Tracy Flick, an overachieving, high-strung candidate, with Matthew Broderick playing her teacher, Mr. M.
Tracy Flick. Tracy Flick. I'd seen a lot of ambitious students come and go over the years, but Tracy Flick, she was a special case.
Some people say I'm an overachiever, but I think they're just jealous. My mom always tells me I'm different, you know, special. And if you look at all the things I've accomplished so far, I think you'd have to agree.
Well, in his new book, Little Children, Tom Perotta takes on the joys and miseries of parenthood and marriage. The title of the first chapter, Bad Mommy, is an indicator of what's to come. Tom Perotta's here to tell us more about Little Children. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Oh, my pleasure, Bill.
Tom, the main characters in Little Children all live in the same town. Todd, the handsome stay-at-home dad, Larry, the soon-to-be-divorced retired cop, and Ronnie, who's a convicted child molester. But I think it's safe to say the main character is Sarah, mother of Lucy. She's a young mother, and she's feeling kind of lost, kind of like a stranger in her own life. Can you read us just a bit from the beginning of the book that gives us an idea where Sarah is coming from? It's set on the local playground.
That's right. Sarah comes to this playground every day with her daughter, and there's a sort of clique of mothers who kind of rule the place. And she has made herself kind of the fourth person in this group, but she feels half in and mostly half out. And this is how she thinks on the day that the story begins. Not that they would, but if any of the other mothers had asked how it was that Sarah, of all people, had ended up married, living in the suburbs, and caring full-time for a small child, she would have blamed it all on a moment of weakness. At least that was how she described it to herself, though the explanation always seemed a bit threadbare. After all, what was adult life but one moment of weakness piled on top of another? Most people just fell in line like obedient little children, doing exactly what society expected of them at any given moment, all the while pretending that they'd actually made some sort of choice.
I want to ask you to tell me a little more about Sarah and how typical you think she is of suburban moms, and also what a challenge it must be for a male novelist to write from inside the mind of a woman, as so much of this book is written.
The first question, how typical is she? Probably not that typical across the board, but maybe in the kind of world that we live in, the kind of highly educated suburbs outside a major city, I think there are a fair number of Sarahs. One of the things I thought of when I started writing this book was a number of people that I knew who I'd gone to college with, and I'd gone to college in the 80s and taught college through the early 90s. So this is the sort of the height of the culture wars and, you know, of feminism's great cultural moment. And I think there were a lot of women that I went to school with who I knew in a kind of maybe the most radical phase of their life when they, you know, defiantly said, you know, I'm not going to live that traditional life. And we all sort of imagined a much more fluid and different kind of set of social arrangements and family arrangements. And I think when I had kids and I was doing something like half-time childcare early on, I suddenly found myself in this traditional world that reminded me of kind of the world my mother had raised kids in. You know, when I got to the playground in the morning, I was the only dad there most of the time. And occasionally I would meet a woman who seemed as outside of that world as I did. And they would make a kind of impression on me. I'd feel like, you know, they were a kind of kindred spirit. And I would feel for them in a way more than for me.
And that's where maybe you found the way in to write from inside the head of a woman.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way to do it, I think, is to try and find out, you know, where you intersect. I mean, in Election, just to jump to another book, I had to write about a teen lesbian character, Tammy Warren. And I did it just by basically making her who I was at that point. You know, I thought of the most alienated kind of mindset that I had as a teenager, and I gave it to her with some external differences that I had to take into account. But internally, I felt very close to her, and I think internally I feel pretty close to Sarah.
It's not just written from inside the head of a woman. There are male characters, and the very important and central character, starts out referred to as the prom king.
The women at the playground, this core group of mothers, are obsessed with this handsome stay-at-home dad. He reminds Sarah when she first sees him of the kind of guys who model underwear in the Sunday supplements, the ones who sort of point off into space, you know, with a fascinated expression.
Both of these main characters alienated from the suburban scene. He's trying to get his life together. Sarah's feeling off to the side.
Yeah, and I think interestingly alienated. You know, he is in some funny way happy to be a stay-at-home dad and happy to discover this maternal side. And she, on the other hand, feels desperate for some kind of public life, for some kind of professional recognition. They're both kind of adrift, and they're both kind of unmoored from their traditional gender roles.
A turning point in the book is involving these two characters and a dare. Can you read us a bit from the book about that?
Yeah, this is the first day that Sarah sees Todd. She's sitting there with the other mothers, and she's feeling particularly alienated from them. And this man who's known as the prom king shows up. And he's having a good time on the swings with his kid, and Sarah's daughter, Lucy, notices this, and this is what happens. Normally, Sarah tried to discourage Lucy from going on the swings. She tended to get hypnotized by the motion, and convincing her to stop invariably turned into a complex negotiation full of threats and bribery, and culminating in an inevitable tantrum. But right now, that seemed like a small price to pay for the chance to show the other mothers that it was possible to treat a good-looking man as if he were an actual human being, rather than some sort of two-dimensional sex object. She rose slowly from the bench, feigning weariness. "Okay, sweetie, I'll be right there." "Wait," Teresa whispered. She had her purse open and was groping for something inside. "What?" said Sarah. Teresa held up her wallet, smirking like a schoolgirl. $5 if you get his phone number.
Which she manages to do. Well, we don't want to give away too much of the plot. Throughout, though, there is a thread of Sarah presented as something of a modern-day Madame Bovary.
Yeah, well, Sarah is an ABD, as we say in the academic world. So she is somebody with...
What's an ABD?
All but dissertation.
Oh.
She's done everything with a dissertation. She sees herself as an intellectual in this world, and she has a literary background. And it just so happens that her next-door neighbor, who likes to take her for evening fitness walks, is a retired school teacher who has a book group. And they do Madame Bovary. And, of course, Madame Bovary is the great ur-text of, you know, adultery among the bourgeoisie.
What is it about the life among the bourgeoisie in America in the 21st century that interests you from the perspective of the shadows on this book? There's a darkness at the heart of a lot of these characters, not to mention the darkness at the heart of the book, Ronnie the child molester, who literally moves into the neighborhood and lives among them, someone who's actually accused of murder.
That's a very good question. I mean, I think that parenthood seemed a really ripe subject to me because we live in a society that places a whole lot of emphasis on individual achievement, on personal satisfaction, on sexual satisfaction, and parenthood asks you to give all that up. And I think, you know, there are probably lots of people who make that transition very successfully, happily, but I happen to think there must be a lot of people who don't make that transition so gracefully, who feel like it's really hard. So there's that, and then there's just the issue of sex in the book, and there's a child molester who's looking at these kids in a sexual way. Sarah's husband, who we haven't mentioned, has become obsessed with a woman who has a website, a kind of exhibitionist website. I was just interested, I think, in this conflict between sexuality and responsibility, sexuality and moral instruction. I also think playground is a ripe idea, you know. Some of us think about our inner child as a kind of innocent, playful person. But, you know, I wanted to think about the fact that if we do have inner children in us, you know, they're also the ones that are little monsters of id, who, you know, kick and scream when they don't get their way. And, you know, the little children, of course, in this book are both the kids who are being protected and the parents who are doing the protecting, who find that, you know, they haven't fully grown up in important ways.
I can't let you go without asking you how it feels to be compared in the New York Times Book Review to Chekhov.
Well,
not bad, I guess.
Not bad. No, I mean, he's the patron saint of realistic writers. I was thrilled by that, and I hope someday I can live up to it.
Tom Perata is author of the new book, Little Children. Tom, thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.